Chapter 68. It is seldom that the historian has to record events more singular than those which occurred during this year, when the crown of France was battled for by no less than four pretenders, with equal claims, merits, bravery, and popularity. First in the list we place His Royal Highness Louis Anthony Frederick Samuel Anna Maria, Duke of Brittany, and son of Louis XVI. The unhappy prince, when a prisoner with his unfortunate parents in the temple, was unable to escape from that place of confinement, hidden for the treatment of the ruffians who guarded him, but caused the young prince to dwindle down astonishingly in the cocked hat of the representative. Reader, it is well known that, in the troublous revolutionary times, cocked hats were worn of a considerable size. He passed a considerable part of his life in Germany, was confined there for 30 years in the dungeons of Spielberg, and, escaping thence to England, was, under pretense of debt, but in reality from political hatred, imprisoned there also in the Tower of London. He must not be confounded with any other of the persons who laid claim to be children of the unfortunate victim of the first revolution. The next claimant, Henry of Bordeaux, is better known. In the year 1843 he held his little fugitive court in furnished lodgings, in a forgotten district of London, called Belgrave Square. Many of the nobles of France flocked thither to him, despising the persecutions of the occupant of the throne, and some of the chiefs of the British nobility, among whom may be reckoned the celebrated and chivalrous Duke of Jenkins, aided the adventurous young prince with their counsels, their wealth, and their valor. The third candidate was His Imperial Highness Prince John Thomas Napoleon, a 14th cousin of the late emperor, and said by some to be a prince of the House of Gomersal. He argued justly that, as the immediate relatives of the celebrated Corsican had declined to compete for the crown which was their right, he, Prince John Thomas, being next in succession, was, undoubtedly, heir to the vacant imperial throne. And in support of his claim, he appealed to the fidelity of Frenchmen and the strength of his good sword. His Majesty Louis Philippe was, it need not be said, the illustrious wielder of the scepter which the three above named princes desired to wrest from him. It does not appear that the sagacious monarch was esteemed by his subjects as such a prince should have been esteemed. The light-minded people, on the contrary, were rather weary than otherwise of his sway. They were not in the least attached to his amiable family, for whom His Majesty with characteristic thrift had endeavored to procure satisfactory allowances. And the leading statesmen of the country, whom His Majesty had disgusted, were suspected of entertaining any but feelings of loyalty towards his house and person. It was against the above-named pretenders that Louis Philippe, now nearly 100 years old, a prince amongst sovereigns, was called upon to defend his crown. The city of Paris was guarded, as we all know, by 124 forts, of 1,000 guns each, provisioned for a considerable time, and also constructed as to fire, if need were, upon the palace of the Tuileries. Thus, should the mob attack it, as in August 1792 and July 1830 the building could be razed to the ground in an hour. Thus too, the capital was quite secure from foreign invasion. Another defense against the foreigners was the state of the roads. Since the English companies had retired, half a mile only of railroad had been completed in France, and thus any army accustomed, as those of Europe now are, to move at 60 miles an hour, would have been annihilated to death before they could have marched from the Rhenish, the Maritime, the Alpine, or the Pyrenean frontier upon the capital of France. The French people, however, were indignant at this defect of communication in their territory, and said, without the least show of reason, that they would have preferred that the 575,000 billions of francs which had been expended upon the fortifications should have been laid out in a more peaceful manner. However, behind his forts, the king lay secure. as it is our aim to depict in as vivid a manner as possible the strange events of the period, the actions, the passions of individuals and parties engaged. We cannot better describe them than by referring to contemporary documents, of which there is no lack. It is amusing at the present day to read in the pages of the Moniteur and the Journal des Debats the accounts of the strange scenes which took place. The year 1884 had opened very tranquilly. The court of the Tuileries had been extremely gay. The 23 youngest princes of England, sons of Her Majesty Victoria, had enlivened the balls by their presence. The Emperor of Russia and family had paid their accustomed visit, and the King of the Belgians had, as usual, made his visit to his royal father-in-law, under pretense of duty and pleasure, but really to demand payment of the Queen of the Belgians' dowry, which Louis-Philippe of Orleans still resolutely declined to pay. Who would have thought that in the midst of such festivity danger was lurking rife, in the midst of such quiet, rebellion? Charenton was the great lunatic asylum of Paris, and it was to this repository that the scornful journalist consigned the pretender to the throne of Louis XVI. But on the next day, viz. Saturday, the 29th February, the same journal contained a paragraph of a much more startling and serious import, in which, although under a mask of carelessness, it was easy to see the government alarm. On Friday, the 28th February, the Journal des Debats contained a paragraph, which did not occasion much sensation at the Bourse, so absurd did its contents seem. It ran as follows. Encore UN Louis XVII! Exclamation point. A letter from Calais tells us that a strange personage lately landed from England, from Bedlam we believe, has been giving himself out to be the son of the unfortunate Louis XVI. This is the 24th pretender of the species who has asserted that his father was the august victim of the temple. Beyond his pretensions, the poor creature is said to be pretty harmless. He is accompanied by one or two old women, who declare they recognize in him the Dauphin. He does not make any attempt to seize upon his throne by force of arms, but waits until heaven shall conduct him to it. If His Majesty comes to Paris, we presume he will take up his quarters in the Palace of Charenton. We have not before alluded to certain rumors which have been afloat among the lowest canaille and the vilest estaminets of the metropolis, that a notorious personage, why should we hesitate to mention the name of the Prince John Thomas Napoleon, has entered France with culpable intentions and revolutionary views. The Moniteur of this morning, however, confirms the disgraceful fact. A pretender is on our shores. An armed assassin is threatening our peaceful liberties. A wandering, homeless cutthroat is robbing on our highways. And the punishment of his crime awaits him. Let no considerations of the past defer that just punishment. It is the duty of the legislator to provide for the future. Let the full powers of the law be brought against him, aided by the stern justice of the public force. Let him be tracked, like a wild beast, to his lair, and meet the fate of one. But the sentence has, ere this, been certainly executed. The brigand, we hear, has been distributing, without any effect, pamphlets among the low alehouses and peasantry of the department of the Upper Rhine in which he lurks, and the police have an easy means of tracking his footsteps. Corporal Crane, of the gendarmerie, is on the track of the unfortunate young man. His attempt will only serve to show the folly of the pretenders, and the love, respect, regard, fidelity, admiration, reverence, and passionate personal attachment in which we hold our beloved sovereign. Second edition. Capture of the Prince. A courier has just arrived at the Tuileries with a report that after a scuffle between Corporal Crane and the Imperial Army, apostrophe in the water barrel, whither the latter had retreated, victory has remained with the former. A desperate combat ensued in the first place, in a hayloft, whence the pretender was ejected with immense loss. He is now a prisoner, and we dread to think what his fate may be. It will warn future aspirants, and give Europe a lesson which it is not likely to forget. Above all, it will set beyond a doubt the regard, respect, admiration, reverence, and adoration which we all feel for our sovereign. Third edition. A second courier has arrived. The infatuated crane has made common cause with the prince, and forever forfeited the respect of Frenchmen. A detachment of the 520th Legion has marched in pursuit of the pretender and his dupes. Go, Frenchmen, go and conquer. Remember that it is our rights you guard, our homes which you march to defend, our laws which are confided to the points of your unsullied bayonets. Above all, our dear, dear sovereign, around whose throne you rally. Our feelings overpower us. Men of the 520th, remember your watchword is Gemuts, your countersign, Vami. The Emperor of Russia and his distinguished family quitted the Tuileries this day. His Imperial Majesty embraced His Majesty the King of the French with tears in his eyes, and conferred upon their RR. HH. The princes of Nemours and Joinville, the Grand Cross of the Order of the Blue Eagle. His Majesty passed a review of the police force. The venerable monarch was received with deafening cheers by this admirable and disinterested body of men. Those cheers were echoed in all French hearts. Long, long may our beloved prince be among us to receive them. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.